You're listening to the Podcast Detroit Network. Visit www.podcastdetroit.com for more information. The views and opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily represent those of the network, its advertisers, owners, or sponsors.
Welcome to the Breakfast Table, the one place where you can find all the opinions on games, movies, and geek culture in audio form.
Hey guys, this is Darshan. Howdy, it's Ferris.
Hey, it's Alex.
And I'm your host, Brad, and today we're here gathered to talk about Ready Player One and other movies that have a very video game influence to them. But, as always, we will be talking very spoilerish things with this movie. I don't think there's any way we could talk about this movie without spoilers, so fair warning there. And we're probably going to get into spoilers on the other movies we talk about, so there's your warning. But Ready Player One came out this weekend to pretty high praise, amazingly, considering most people hated the book with a passion. And Steven Spielberg managed to do it again, giving us a good movie from a very not good book.
So, yeah, it came out with at least $30 million so far made opening weekend. Expected to make at least 50 or more. Came out on Wednesday for most people.
What, was that the early release one?
The early release was on Wednesday, and then the actual release date was the 29th. They moved it from the 30th because of Good Friday. But then I realized something, that it came out on Easter weekend for a reason, because the movie is about Easter eggs.
Yeah, the whole movie
the whole
is about an
Easter
egg,
egg theme going on, and it's a great Easter movie. So yeah, great.
I wouldn't count it as an Easter movie going forward, though, at all.
Yeah.
No, it's definitely an Easter movie. Yeah.
But a great reason to release it on an Easter weekend, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, just looking at the numbers, it's already made $53 million domestic, and then it's $181 million worldwide.
I was going to say, the moment it hits China.
Yeah.
It's
and even the, it's doing so well that the writer of the book, he
Ernest
also
Cline?
Wrote the movie. Him. I don't remember his name, but he's actually now starting working on a second book. I think he started doing it like a couple weeks ago when the movie was already starting to get really good reviews. He started to, you know, kind of work on it, but now that it's actually doing well, he's already said, "Yep, I already have a second book in the making." So I think that this movie is doing well for him, even though, like you said, a lot of people didn't like his book.
Yeah. So you're right, Alex. A draft has been written for the sequel to Ready Player One, and this movie companies are waiting until they look at how much money this movie makes, obviously, to determine if it'll have a sequel feature. Mm-hmm. So everything's kind of getting their ducks in a row, which is any movie that you watch. I think we talked about it last week, sequels, our favorite sequel series.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm hoping it doesn't have the same formula that most sequels have, where it ends up.
And in this one, they actually even said that the sequel for his book is not going to be based off the movie, because the movie, from what I understand, veers way away from the book, which I guess is for the best.
Not really.
Yeah, but I mean, he said that a lot of stuff that happens in the book is not going to change on what happens in the next sequel. It's going to be like a direct sequel to the book. So if they make a sequel movie, it's going to follow the movie. Same thing as they didn't really follow the book as much, I guess.
So the best way I conclude this movie, if, you know, in regards to the book, in regards to the comparison of the movie itself, is that if you've never read the book and you see this movie, you're going to have a good time. But if you've read the book and you go to see this movie, you're going to have some doubts about it. And obviously you can say that about a lot of book to movie, you know, things that come out. But at the same time, you know, there's some details that they missed out on, and there's some things that they also included, you know.
The doubts come from a different light, though. Yeah. Most people that go, oh, man, they're turning my favorite book into a movie, they go, I hope that they don't ruin the movie. People that are – who have read the book and going, oh, man, that wasn't a good book, that's probably not going to translate to a good movie at all. So when he's going, oh, yeah, I'm going to write a sequel to the book, I kind of hope he skips the book part of it and just goes, we're just writing a movie sequel. We're going to forget that we're releasing it as a book.
Mm-hmm. Well, when I was listening to the audiobook by Will Wheaton, I don't know, I got caught in that zone. Interestingly enough, to me, it felt like it wasn't a book, but like an overly written movie script, or like
it comes off as fan fiction.
Or fan fiction. Yeah, that's the vibe that I got from enjoying, you know, the audiobook from it. And in fact, I felt like the whole scenario in what they were describing. It was so overly descriptive, talking about the scenarios that they were in and less about the plot that was going along with the book. I felt that they were just talking about the kind of the background and the situation and the environment that they were in more so than the experience of the storyline, you know? And in the movie, obviously, it focused on the storyline more, but then, you know, they had the visual appeal to kind of back everything up.
The difference is when you're reading the book and – I read the book a little bit after it came out. It came out in like 2010, if I recall correctly. And the book kind of reads like, then the Iron Giant came in and the TIE fighter went over its head before the, you know, orc from World of Warcraft came in and axed Chucky from the Chucky movies. And pretty much almost every paragraph ends with, and then the TIE fighter from Star Wars flew over. It doesn't read well at all, which the one thing is there's a lot of Star Wars references in the book. I didn't catch a single one in the movie.
The only one I noticed is when they were going to the weird club, there were X-Wings waiting in line.
Most of it was audio. So like when he said my Padawan, and then and then also later he said, I can give you the Millennium Falcon. He said, oh, really? You can give me that? I think when he was talking to
the boss man.
Yeah. He said, okay, you can get that for me. And then apparently R2-D2 was somewhere in the background that
I heard about that one.
Yeah. And then apparently like Obi-Wan wasn't there, but like someone was wearing his robes. So like apparently they had some issues with Disney with a lot of that stuff. So I guess they had to be very careful with it.
They kept it generic.
Yeah. They kept it very hidden, I guess.
I think that was proven false on the Disney thing. I think it was more Steven Spielberg didn't want to focus too much on one franchise. And Star Wars is the one that sticks out because literally every sentence in the book references Star Wars in some way. Like going, and he had a weapon, kind of like a lightsaber in Star Wars, and then a TIE fighter, kind of like in Star Wars, flew by, and then this from Star Wars, and well, Star Wars, Star Wars, Star Wars.
Here's where I'm coming from about the book in regards to the movie. Like, Wade Watts in the book talks about how he grew up on the Oasis, how, you know, his father died, and how his mother had to work on the Oasis console as like a sex line worker, and he would kind of at nighttime when she was like on the phone or whatever, making funny noises to her clients, he would kind of put the headphones on and kind of mask out the noise by watching 80s TV shows like Family Ties and things like that. So he talked about being in the console, being in the system and the virtual environment, growing up in it, talking about like, you know, how he was playing with virtual Big Bird and Sesame Street on it. And then like he also talked about the first chance that he could when he was in public school to go and continue his high school education on the Oasis console. And the console that he has is actually an education school issued Oasis console. And that's how he gets onto the, you know, system and stuff like that. So the actual history of and behind the scenes and in-depth overview of what goes on wasn't really accurately described in the movie. It was just kind of, you know, this is the Oasis and this is, you know, it's cool. And, you know, a lot of cool shit happens there. And, you know, in the book, they kind of broke it down that he was raised on it and there's a society that has, you know, been basically dependent on it. And, you know, they kind of gave a way better background sense and understanding of like the economics of, you know, the whole thing.
Yeah. The book definitely went into more detail on certain parts, but it went into a lot of unnecessary detail as well.
Yeah, it did.
That's the problem with it. The movie, while it did get rid of some details that were really cool from the book, like I remember Daito and Sho were more prevalent in the book than they were in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And Ferris, you were even making the comment earlier that, you know, after we saw the movie, they didn't really have any. Yeah,
it was like the first hour, like you heard of them, like they, like obviously when they showed them on like the planet Doom and they were like fighting people, it was like, oh yeah, like it, they kind of just described them as like rivals almost. Like it seemed like someone like, these are people you don't want to meet on the battlefield. And then like after they showed them in real life and how they were like all buddy buddy, then it seemed like they were more prevalent in the series or like in the movie because of it.
Yeah, their character, like you said, definitely picked up more in the second half of the movie than the first half when they were in real life.
Yeah. As soon as they got in the van, it changed everything for them. So
Yeah, even then it was kind of, they went, oh yeah, we showed them how to do the first challenge and then that was it pretty much for them. And then they were there for the second challenge.
Well, the one thing that actually I found confusing too about it, they were – I can't remember exactly what book – that's what they were talking about. When they were talking about The Shining, I believe Sho was talking about how he read the book with his hands.
No, and he saw the movie between his fingers.
No, H asked him, how scary is this movie? And he said, I have to watch it through my fingers or something like
and
that.
Like, and when I heard that, I was like, wait, is he blind? Like, that's what I heard that.
No, he's an 11-year-old kid, and he just watched The Shining.
Yeah,
that's why. He had to watch it between his fingers, basically. Yeah.
I was, like, sitting here, I was like, that's even cooler. How do you use a weight that's blind? So that's what I was actually excited for something like that, and I was like, wait, he's not blind. Come on. So
I think that part of the movie was great, because in the theater, you kind of just went, like, nudged over to me and was like, I've never seen The Shining before. Is any of this accurate?
It's like after they said that, where's this like after Aix was like, I've never seen The Shining before. And then I lean over to you. I've never seen The Shining before.
Hey, but that's cool thing. You could relate, right?
Yeah.
You got a character to relate to.
I was just, I felt attacked.
The best part is when like the ball comes in and everything like that, everybody in the theater is like, oh my God, it's a reference to The Shining. And you're just going, yeah, that's a ball. They threw a ball in the hallway. Good for them.
And then the twins, yeah.
I didn't understand any of it.
I even think that sequence had one of the funniest parts in the movie is when whenever they finished that quest, and at the end, when they're back at the big boss's lair, he's like, all we have to do is get through The Shining. You see everyone in the background screaming and trying to run away because they didn't know what to do in the thing, because everyone keeps on dying. I think that was probably one of the funniest sequences in the movie too.
Hey Alex, I know you're a sucker for CGI detail like me. What'd you think of the elevator scene with the liquid, the blood flowing out?
That was good. And speaking of that, I thought that part was good, but I think my favorite part in this movie, CGI wise, was the dance sequence. When they're in that club and they start dancing. Like whenever Artemis's dress kind of turns into like a turns into like wind kind of thing. Like it kind of disperses and it looks like she's like almost like a ghost, I guess. Like that entire sequence was just amazing CGI wise.
Yeah, that dress actually changed color as she was moving around.
Yeah, it changed color and it kind of made it look like she was like she was actually flying, and it looked like, you know how like when you see like a ghost and it's kind of like broken up, kind of like a spirit type of thing. It kind of looked like that. Her dress is kind of like, it felt like her dress came alive, and just the way it kind of transformed was just freaking amazing. But even in that blood scene was pretty good. The way that it moved and of course the color.
Yeah, the way that the liquid moved in that particular scene, I've never seen liquid move in that type of way in any CGI form in a film before. I thought it was really excellently done.
Especially when it captures like, because I mean it could have just came out seeping through the thing, but it came out like very similar to the movie. It came out like it was rushing out of the elevator and splashing down and covering up the area. It was very well done.
And not only that, but the references in the movie throughout the entire movie, they were great.
Oh, let's blow off all the references that we saw. I saw like Hello Kitty, obviously Back to the Future, Star Wars a little bit.
We got obviously Michael Jackson Thriller.
Yeah.
We have Prince. It was
Prince
in Purple Rain.
Yes.
That was good.
Duran.
Oh, Battletoads, Ninja Turtles.
Yep. Yeah, they were.
Spawn was in there, who I missed the first time because I was too focused on Tracer Fares. And then, and then of course a lot of DC characters, Batgirl was in there a couple times.
Tracer was in it a couple times.
Yeah. They paid for that spot.
Ryu was in there quite a few times.
Yeah, Ryu was in the race.
He was getting in a car.
Well, he was in the race. He was in the beginning. He was in when he was buying like the items. And of course at the end, Parsifal used the Hadouken near the end.
Yeah.
There was, and of course, one thing I missed too, Lara Croft was in there.
She was in there a couple times in the battle scenes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I missed her. Chun-Li, of course.
Iron Giant,
yes. Blanca. Blanka was in the club scene. He Mecha was kind of in the background.
That Mecha Godzilla was the worst representation I've seen of any Mecha Godzilla.
Really?
That was literally just a robot version of Godzilla. But like the movies have always gone very generic. Like it's literally just let's get the word robot and Godzilla together. But this one was just like, all right, we got to go super mecha. And I was just like, I don't understand what I'm looking at. I only knew it was Godzilla because
they had the Firefly ship in there too.
Yeah, that was Serenity.
Oh, they had a lot of the...
And I was actually speaking of that scene with Mechagodzilla, that scene has the biggest one, in my opinion, the Gundam. The Gundam
scene. That was awesome.
Yeah. The old-style Gundam, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the cool thing about it, too, because if I remember correctly, Planet Doom is from Voltron. So we both got the Gundam and Voltron references in almost the same exact scene, mm-hmm. which is probably something we'll never get ever in our lives again. So even though we didn't actually see a Voltron in there, we actually got the Planet Doom from Voltron, and then you had Gundam fighting on it. And mm-hmm. I thought that was pretty freaking sweet.
Yeah, this is one of the few movies where you can go, oh yeah, who's fighting Mechagodzilla? A Gundam and the Iron Giant? Okay, mm-hmm. okay. And what are they doing on the ground? Oh, they're shooting it with the rocket launcher from Halo as they're grabbing the gun from Gears of War with the chainsaw and everything.
Yeah.
What is it?
Cool.
IROC, I want to say. Or not IROC. Somebody on the battlefield when they went to Planet Doom the first time was using the assault rifle from Halo. Like, at first I didn't notice it.
I think that was...
It was H. H was a rifle. Yeah, it was H.
So there was definitely a lot of cameos and a lot of appearances.
If I recall correctly, the licensing for just getting everything, it was like a list of 1,000 different licenses they had to get, which obviously that doesn't mean there's 1,000 different references, because just with Halo, they had to get Microsoft, Bungie, they had to get the person that, designed it and stuff
Looney
like that.
Tunes characters in there too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the good thing about it, because the movie was produced by Warner Brothers. So a lot of their characters they already had rights to, like the DC characters. Mm-hmm. If I remember correctly, I even think they have the rights to Akira, which is why they were able to put the Akira bike in there.
Well, they're making the live action one, aren't they?
That's what I thought, because Artemis was riding the Akira bike in the first race scene. So so a lot of the stuff Warner Brothers already owned, which was good enough for them. So the money they saved on those licenses, I guess they were able to use on to get, quite a few other licenses and stuff like that. So the good thing about Warner Bros. Producing is that they didn't have to pay extra for it, I guess.
I can say the one thing I was disappointed about in the racing scene was I didn't see the Tron motorcycle. Mm-hmm. I was hoping for a Tron motorcycle in that scene.
But then that also explains Disney. They would have to go back in and get something from that.
I have a really good feeling there's going to be like a director's cut or some kind of version that you're going to want to buy soon off that Blu-ray, that's going to have all the deleted scenes or extra scenes.
I'm going to do a frame by frame when that DVD comes out.
Oh, yeah.
I will admit, the first time I saw it, I actually stopped paying attention to the movie because I was too busy looking in the background for people. I had to go see it twice
because I had to go pay attention more about the background than I did the foreground in the conversation. Mm-hmm. But it was interesting that the CGI that they did in the movie, they like kind of blurred it in a certain way that where they wanted you to focus on certain things mm-hmm. and not focus on other things. So, they kind of did it in a purposeful way.
Right.
Which, makes sense. But yeah, I went on Wikipedia and I looked up the movie and I found out that their budget for the movie was at $175 million. And they've already made $181.2 million this weekend. So.
Okay. That's worldwide, though.
Yeah, worldwide.
Most of the times when it's a domestic movie, they don't look at the worldwide when it comes to making a sequel. They'll look at the domestic mm-hmm. and see if they made it back in domestic.
Mm-hmm. Because I don't know if it already hit Japan and China yet, but once this movie hits China and Japan, that worldwide number is going to go up because they're really big in VR over there. And if once that movie comes out over there, I think that movie's going to destroy records overseas.
So with a $175 million budget, I'm sure a good chunk of it was to get trademarking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And visuals.
Oh, probably.
Yeah.
Well, the whole movie is just visual CG. So that's the biggest chunk of it is going to be the CG, then it would be getting the licensing and property rights.
And the sound, surround sound, was all done by Lucasfilm, which was pretty cool. I saw it in Dolby Atmos, and it was really good. Most of the visual effects, surprisingly enough, were not like outsourced to companies that were in India, you know, those crazy shops out there that do most of the video production for visual effects. It was like a very international cast that was done, you know, throughout. So I thought, okay. You know, I was really impressed by that.
Yeah, it definitely looked beautiful. And everything blended well together, too. So when you have Hello Kitty walking next to the Battletoads, it doesn't look out of place somehow in right. this movie. It all blended very yeah. well.
Every action yeah. scene was boxed correctly, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, and speak of that, I think one of the coolest scenes regarding that was whenever Artemis was dressed as Goro, and then she had the alien come out of her chest, and then she used it to kind of like, you know, slice up, you know, to reveal herself, and then she had the alien on her arm. I thought that was a really cool scene because it blended so well. It's like they're able to go have it come out of Goro's chest and then kind of use it as scissors to kind of eat up the, you know, reveal her. I thought that was a really cool like exposition with trying to reveal who she was.
Yeah, the whole thing with the disguises as well, like the Clark Kent glasses that just kind of blur your face a little bit, but they don't change your appearance.
Right.
So let me get this right about the whole plot line in regards to Halliday. And what's the other guy's name?
Morrow.
Is that his name?
Yep.
Ogden Morrow.
Morrow. Okay. So Halliday met this Karen chick like a couple of years before Morrow did and had an opportunity to date her and then kind of didn't seize the moment and kiss her. So the whole relationship kind of fell through. So what, like years later, Ogden Morrow meets the Karen chick and then they end up getting married, right?
Yeah.
A little bit. Okay, just follow me here. Just correct me if I'm wrong. And so they kind of get married, and in a way, Halliday develops a little bit of jealousy here and then pushes him out of the company.
Yes, that's what I understand. He fell in love with Karen, but he didn't take the leap, as they say in the movie. So, and then I'm guessing that Mara met her and they got married, and then he was jealous in a way. And he made Ogden Morrow, you know, sell his shares back.
Yeah,
he basically, you know, which is why at the end he said, "Don't make the same mistake I did," and he basically told him, "Hey, you're selling all your shares back to me." He was being kind of, you know, an a-hole.
Yeah, that's what I thought. I was like, dude, this guy is like, you know, revolutionary. Like, is he the next Steve Jobs? You know, and I'm like, wait, this guy's kind of an asshole. Like, well,
he was socially inept.
Yeah.
That's the thing.
Yeah, I got the point of that towards the end. He was like, you know, I was looking at the Oasis as a place to escape, but, you know, coming back to the real world, it's where you could get a decent meal, is what he said. Mm-hmm. You know, and I got what he was trying to say with that. His biggest regret was, you know, losing his best friend instead. But, you know, I just thought of that. I was just kind of like, you know, what kind of an asshole in a way that he kind of did that. You know, kicked his buddy out, you know, of like – a giant corporation. And then again, that is kind of a Steve Jobs move, but yes.
Oh, 100% of Steve Jobs. Steve Jobs did that. He kicked out everybody except for Wozniak out of Apple.
Yep.
Like the original team.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, that is a 100% Steve Jobs move.
So, I don't know.
He's a visionary though. Don't back talk.
Don't talk about Steve Jobs.
Don't talk about Steve Jobs like that. He's a saint.
Everybody check your iPhones.
But yeah, there was actual character to everybody in this film too. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just, you know, washed down, I'm a bad guy. No, he had a reason for what he wanted to do. He resented Halliday for never listening to him when he was an intern and everything like that. You know, he wanted to take control of it because he wanted to prove that he could do this.
You're talking about the boss man?
Yeah, boss man. Which the sticky note.
I don't know
note,
his name, but I call him the boss man too.
The sticky note on his chair, I lost at that scene because as somebody in IT, that's too real.
Yeah, dude, I lost it at the Avatar, you know, with the suit and everything.
The giant chiseled, you know, yeah. It was definitely a look at me kind of Avatar.
Yeah, and like when he was trying to prove that he was like he was like Wade when he was trying to prove that he knew the knowledge, but he actually had someone talking in his ear. Like he's like that businessman that doesn't really know about those references, so he's trying to like make himself cool and try to, you know, win him over and stuff like that when all he was trying to do is, you know, basically get him to give him the key and stuff like that. It's like all those characteristics were just that typical, you know, CEO, you know, who wants to take over something type of thing, you know?
Yeah. Also, you can't hate a movie that just has a random cameo by Simon Pegg. I was not expecting him in this movie. When he appeared at first, I was like, oh, that's a good cameo right there. And then he kept showing up throughout the movie. I was like, this is getting even better.
Twist at the end.
Yes.
With who he played.
Yeah. Oh, that was perfect.
You know, like, in on a side bit of, like, weird things that kind of were speckled across the movie, that whole, like, the hitman idea that he had with, like, the girl who went to go blow up the stacks and stuff like that, like, her character made no sense. Like, she was there.
You're talking about the one that...
Like, the girl bodyguard?
The muscle?
Yeah, the muscle. Yeah, like
the muscle chick?
It's just like, in a world that's so digital, it's like, why is there muscle?
Well, hey, man. The future is female. That's all I got to say.
Just turn off the internet. Like, like, that was, like, the extent. I was like, I understand the whole idea of, like, motivating him and kind of, like, scaring him of what the real world is when, like, they blew up the stacks and killed his aunt and his, like, aunt's boyfriend and all that. But it's just like, they could have done the same thing without killing him. Like, they would have probably
just
done
shut
all
off
that.
The Wi-Fi connection.
Right.
Like, in that area.
Right. They could have literally gone up there and just kept harassing them to the point where he can't get inside. And it would have been enough to, like, hey, I need to go somewhere. You know, I mean, he was still going to get chloroformed into the rebellion. So
the best way to join the rebellion.
Right. Like, I was expecting him to, like, obviously, I mean, that was the whole purpose is, like, the guy with the scar or,
the
like,
fake
the tattoo
out.
Was supposed to be him. And then it was like, who is this Zooey Deschanel ripoff? So.
And speaking of, like, other villains, I'm like, the guy, I guess, who played Irok, I guess the name is.
T.J. Miller.
T.J. Miller, yeah. I was actually surprised we didn't see, like, a little thing of who he was in the real world, but I guess that's fine, I guess. I was surprised that after the whole thing where near the end he got destroyed, we heard, like, nothing else of him. Like, no little, you know, oh, I'm going to – I'm guessing if they ever do make a sequel, they're going to make him probably a bigger bad guy. He's like, oh, you made me lose 10 years worth of, you know, gold and stuff like that. I'm, you know, going to make you pay or something like that. I'm going to be surprised if they make a sequel, he's going to be the bad guy.
I saw, like, some studio shots, you know, while they were making the movie of him on set.
T.J. Miller?
T.J. Miller, maybe. Maybe I'm getting you confused with, like, another show, but – I feel like he was in a few recorded scenes. Maybe they didn't include him in the movie.
He probably went in for voice acting.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You can definitely tell based off like how the character kind of, you know, moved and stuff. But you could tell it was T.J. Miller. Just the way like he kind of, you know, rocked his head back when he was making a joke and he moved. I don't know. It kind of felt like T.J. Miller, if you know what I mean. So
they definitely did some mocap with him at.
Oh, yeah.
In a little bit at
for
least.
Sure. What I liked about the movie, too, was kind of like the interaction and dialogue because in the future, everyone is so encapsulated into the Oasis and being on kind of like VR chat that they don't have like real life interaction skills. So like when you could see, you know, Wade Watts talking to like his aunt's boyfriend and things like that, that it just like escalated real quickly. You know, there was just kind of like a shoot off type of cyberbullying kind of, you know, dialogue that was going on the whole time. So kind of gamer dialogue. Just I don't know. I just thought that was kind of cool that like the real life situations like kind of had that awkwardness that was associated with it because, you know, they've been in the game for so long. It's just a part of their lives. So when they like kind of converse, it's just like they can't do it right.
Yeah, everybody is socially awkward in the real world.
Like when Samantha talks to Wade on the roof, he's like, by the way, I'm not disappointed at all. Like, it's not what you would say.
The dialogue sounds so fake, but it sounds so fake, it becomes real at that point. It's like, oh, God, this is painful to watch, but I believe
it. That's how it is in real life.
Yeah, that's how it would make sense that that's the way it would be because, you know, they've been on the internet so long that, you know, it's hard to have organic conversations with people.
Right. That aren't interrupted by Master Chief blowing away Hello Kitty. But
I'm sorry. Yeah, I was just saying, like, especially with that, what H said, which said, like, oh, she can be some dude, 300-pound dude who lives in Detroit named Chuck.
Yeah, in her mom's basement.
Yeah, I think that was, like, one of the best lines in the movie.
It's a little too painfully true, though. Especially when you find out about that character being a female and everything like that.
Who's 11-year-old? Yeah, the 11-year-old kid's like, what do you want, a sign on my face that says I'm 11 years old?
Show? Yeah, I think that's show.
Oh, man. Why do I break everything?
So, for context here, Ferris managed to lean back in the studio and somehow grab a foam plate from the wall and peel it off.
The acoustic foam.
The acoustic foam.
And the funny thing is, like, we were talking about this. This is a complete sidebar to whatever we were talking about. But it's just like we moved rooms because of this, because the other room was in disrepair. And I was like, oh, yeah. The last one went in. I was like, yeah, Brad, look, you ripped off a piece like I used to. And then I sit in this room for 20 minutes and I've ripped something off the wall already.
I think the best part is you didn't even mean to. You just leaned back and then it was just in your head. You're just like, what just happened here?
I was like, where do I put it, on the table? Either way, but I guess going back to it, one thing that, like, I wish they would have gone over more, and I'm really hoping that, like, we are definitely putting a lot of hope into a secondary movie, but I didn't feel like they went over the artifacts too much. Like, we only saw, like, one or two. Like, we saw, like, obviously we saw the gauntlet that they never really went into any further. Obviously we saw, like, I'm just going to say the bubble shield, you know.
The D20 dice?
Yeah, the D20 dice. Obviously we saw, like, what was it? Zemeckis Cube?
Yeah, the Zemeckis Cube.
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
Any of the weapons that we saw in action. There weren't like extra weapons or anything that was added to it. But yeah, like the Zemeckis Cube, the X1 suit, which was the thing that you could buy in real life. And then what was it? The Catalyst? That thing that like blew up everything that was on the planet?
Yeah, that's one that killed everyone. Yeah.
So like everything that you saw was used, including the glove that turned that one guy into a Gundam.
Yeah, that was the glove at the very beginning of the movie
that they were fighting for.
Yeah. Like, I kind of wish they kind of went into more detail with that one, because in the book, if I recall correctly, they show that Daito basically has a collection of all these artifacts because he just keeps winning. Like, he is the person that you go, oh, he's in that cut. You know, I'm not even going to bother. He's got this.
He's that hardcore E-League type of gamer that you would see on the scene. You know?
Yeah.
Okay.
And, yeah, of course, when they did the reveal of he has that, you know, form of Gundam, the silence in the theater as everybody's just going, hold on a minute, did he just say? Is this happening?
Well, if you read the item, it says you can control a level 99 robot or something like that. I don't think it said anything about a Gundam.
Anything you want for 30 seconds.
Yeah.
The form of anything.
Any robot.
It didn't even say robot. It just anything for 30 seconds.
Okay. Maybe I'm confused with the
that was a great one because, like I said, because in the movie he's just sitting there for like in game in the movie he's like sitting there for like 10 minutes just sitting there doing nothing.
Yeah.
They keep on saying, "Hey, Daito, when are you going to do something?" And he just opens his eyes and he's all like, "I call upon the power of Gundam," and then everyone in our theater just freaked out. Like it was a build up, and no one knew what was going to happen, and it just happened out of nowhere. It ended up being one of the greatest like references in the movie.
It was the perfect nerd moment.
Oh yeah,
that I don't think there was another moment that got the theater silent just from words in that movie than form of Gundam.
And the funny thing is that there's a lot of people who are probably really excited for that Gundam, but probably can't name the model number.
I can raise my hand to that one because
I can't name it either.
It's RX-78.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's plastered like on its right shoulder.
I was too busy being in kid mode going, Gundam fighting Mechagodzilla?
Well, it's funny because there was a Gundam reference last week we talked about in Pacific Rim as well.
Yeah. Yeah, the statue in the middle of Fuji.
Mount Fuji that wouldn't be there 40 years later after its conception, yes.
Yeah, because you mentioned, Ferris, I think the actual statue's in Tokyo.
Yes.
And they show the actual statue of Mount Fuji, which, I mean, there's giant, you know, kaiju running around. Maybe they have to move the statue eventually in the next 40 years of the future, but.
Yeah, or, you know, dismantle it, whichever one.
Yeah. But Ready Player One is a good movie. Highly recommend everybody check it out if you get a chance.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
but there are other video game other movies that have video game influences in them. The other recent one we got was Jumanji Welcome to the Jungle, which was actually a decent movie, which hurts me to say because I did not have any hope for the movie at all. I literally went into the movie going, this is going to be bad, and walked out going, that was a good movie.
It wasn't necessarily like a sequel. Was it? It was more of like
it was a sequel in a way. It
was a tribute to the first one in a way.
Yeah, It made you think that, hey, this could be a sequel, but it isn't because of the way that they changed the actual board game to a cartridge. Like, it could have been something that happened, but they're not. But they don't mention what happened before, basically.
Yeah, and then
I thought that was a good movie.
Yeah, that was a good one that had like a lot of video game logic mixed into the movie. That you selected a character, you were in the game, you controlled that character, and then everything was just video game wackiness from there. And I think one of the reasons I actually like that movie is because it takes a lot of the same cues that my favorite movie of all time does, Scott Pilgrim.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Baby Driver.
Oh, no, that Scott... Baby, same director. It counts.
Yeah.
That is a really good, that's probably your favorite, isn't it, Brad?
Oh, hands down, that's my favorite movie of all time.
You know, the funny thing
time,
is I've never...
And it's got Video Game Incorporation.
Oh, yeah.
I've never known that it was a favorite movie.
Oh, yeah.
I knew you liked Edgar Allan.
Edgar Wright?
Edgar Allan Poe.
Yeah, you know, honestly, I thought it would be like Wreck-It Ralph or something for Brad.
Really?
Yeah.
That's a good movie.
I was expecting that he was like as much as we've talked bad about Fast and Furious, like he was going to talk about, yeah, that's my favorite franchise. Like, I was expecting that.
Well, cars go fast, man.
He did
man.
Talk about how much he loved Spider-Man last week.
Yeah, like Spider-Man 2 was his favorite movie.
And you just gave him the nastiest stank face I've ever seen anybody. Like, you just like ate 20 lemons.
Ferris was very upset by that statement last podcast. But yeah, Scott Pilgrim is my hands down favorite movie, and it takes a lot of video game logic in it. Like, down to joking about it with beating the boss and, ooh, coins. You know, this isn't even enough for a bus. And it's just great. And I love that kind of, you know, mix of video game logic into reality. And they did that in Jumanji, and I loved it. They did it in Scott Pilgrim. It's my favorite movie. Obviously, I like it.
And we're forgetting about, we're forgetting about the one that most likely started it all, and that was Tron, like the original Tron.
Oh, yeah. I love Tron. My, like, tag, oh, yeah, guys, follow me on Twitter, Sony Tron. Snapchat, Sony Tron. Facebook, Sony Tron. Everything I'm all about is Tron.
Yeah.
It's one of my favorite, you know, movies from yesteryear. Mm-hmm. What I liked about the whole thing is, you know, the amount of CGI they used. Mm-hmm. Another one of my favorite of that era was The Last Starfighter. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you guys remember that one, but that was an absolute classic. And Wade Watts in Ready Player One actually referenced that in the book, but then in the movie, as it was one of his favorite movies. I liked it. I wish that was like one of those The Last Starfighter in particular, I wish it was one of those movies that were still like popular and relevant in pop culture today, because it's like one of those movies that are timeless, because it's about a kid that beats an arcade and then gets recruited for like a galactic agency to like, you know, save the universe or whatever. It's pretty sweet. Right. Can't beat that plot. You know, Tron is really cool. You get sucked into a system and then you have to like, you know, fight your way out of it. And then what I really liked about the remake they did with Tron Legacy, I thought that was really
Remake. No, that was a sequel.
Yeah, it was a sequel. Sorry. But yeah, the Tron Legacy was great. I mean, I saw that with my nephew in 3D when it came out.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, Daft Punk was in it and doing cool music.
They did the entire soundtrack for that movie.
It was great. Yeah.
I loved it.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. And I was like saying, like, speaking with like special effects, like the original Tron, like back then, the special effects in that movie were so good that the Oscars deemed them cheating.
Yes.
Like, that's why it didn't get nominated for as an Oscar, because they actually deemed it as cheating.
Yeah, because they didn't do like, actual on-set effects. They did all computer generated graphics. They felt at that time that was, you know,
not allowed.
Yeah, it was a shortcut to movie making. Mm-hmm.
And look where we are today.
Everything is that. Everything.
But yeah, even Tron Legacy, that is a beautiful movie.
Oh, yeah.
It just, even today, if you go watch it, you know, you can turn the sound off. The plot's not very good for that one.
No, it was great.
For Tron Legacy?
Amazing.
You talking about the soundtrack?
No, the soundtrack was good.
About the plot line.
No, the plot line was great.
Oh, plot line was good too.
Yeah,
I liked the plot line. Yeah,
I did not like the plot for.
I mean,
Tron.
you like Spider-Man 2. We can't even.
The thing about it is, like, you can't. I'm sad. I'm saddened by the fact that I don't think I'm going to see any more Trons, because they kind of left it a little bit open. You know. with the girl getting out of the whole Tron system and into the real world. Mm-hmm. But Tron Legacy and The Last Starfighter are probably my top three, you know, films with the video game influence in them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And looking at it, like, I think another one we also mentioned briefly was, of course, Wreck-It Ralph. I think that movie was probably the biggest movie that was for everyone. Like, even if you weren't a big, because Scott Pilgrim, while amazing, it's a cult classic. I mean, it's one of those
movies. It was
movies
a very targeted movie.
Exactly. But when you have something like Wreck-It Ralph, that movie did well for a reason, because it took those references and it made it easy for everyone to understand. You know, you had Bowser, you had, you know, Zangief sitting in a villain's, because, you know, it's like, you know, Bowser's a bad guy, so of course he's going to be in a circle of villains. Like, they made that movie for they did what Disney does best. They make it so children can enjoy it, but also adults who know these references, unlike, you know, a movie like Pixels, where that just went somewhere entirely on the opposite end. You know, Wreck-It Ralph was what a lot of these movies want to do. While most movies may be really, really good, they never achieved what Wreck-It Ralph could do. And that's just kind of an example on how to make a movie based off a video game for, like, a widespread audience.
Yeah, because that one had the characters everybody knows, like mm-hmm. Sonic, Hubert. Bowser, Q-Bert, and then it went into things like Burger Time, what was the bar one?
Root Beer Tap or something.
Root Beer Tap.
And speaking of that, you know, and also they had the references that adults may know. You know, there's, like, you know, like you said, those old arcade games and stuff like that. And going back to Ready Player One, I felt like that's what that movie did well as well, is because they had those references that older people could reference, you know, like Prince.
This movie is definitely focused on those Gen Xers with kids.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. That's what this movie is all about. If you grew up in the 80s and you have a child now, mm-hmm. this is what you're going to take your kid to along with, you know, you, and you're both going to love it.
Yeah. And then we have the sequel for Wreck-It Ralph 2. Yeah. With Wreck-It Ralph 2.
Ralph Breaks the Internet. Yeah.
That one's going to be another whole just nostalgia fest of references throughout, because mm-hmm. originally, before Ready Player One became something they were making into a movie, Wreck-It Ralph was seen as that, oh my god, all these references in the same movie from all these different companies and characters and stuff, this is incredible. And then the sequel is like, oh yeah, we're gonna get even more in the sequel, and that's going to be insane to watch. And we're getting two movies that are basically 100% going on nostalgia factor, with Ready Player One that just came out this last weekend, and then Wreck-It Ralph 2, which comes out in November, I want to say.
November. Yeah, Incredibles is in summertime, so Wreck-It Ralph would be November. Yeah.
Hey, I want to bring up something as a side note. We talked about, I think, video game, not sequels, but a couple weeks ago, video game movies. Remember how we thought that there might be a Mario movie that might be in the making, mm-hmm. Yeah. as a potential thing? I looked into it a little bit more, and I was on Reddit this morning, and there was a bunch of AMAs because it's like Easter Sunday, and there was just a bunch of AMAs on there. And I was
were a joke. Those weren't real.
No, it's got it. Were they real or fake?
They were all fake.
Oh god, because they were talking about Dwayne The Rock Johnson being on one, and then yeah. He had a casting call for the Mario Time Machine movie that was supposed to be coming out.
Yeah, that was a joke, because they faked having each of those people answer one question, and then they had to leave because of a casting call for something.
Yes.
The Mario movie.
I had to leave for a casting call for a Mario Time Machine movie that's coming out.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my God.
Yeah, that was an April Fool's Day joke. Fooled. You totally got suckered into that one. Mario movie that's coming up is being made by Illumination.
Okay.
It is something that's happening. But speaking of Nintendo and movies, there is that one video game movie that yes. everybody forgets, but everybody cherishes.
With one of my favorite all-time actors, Fred Savage.
Yes.
Oh.
The movie that literally was an hour and a half advertisement leading up to Super Mario Bros. 3.
Yeah.
The Wizard.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody forgets about that one.
That came out in December 1989.
Yeah. Because that was the first time they ever showed Super Mario Bros. 3. Like, it hadn't even been shown to the world yet.
It was about, like, three kids. They traveled to California. And, like, I think one of the kids, like, his youngest brother was – I don't know if he was, like, on the spectrum.
He was a prodigy.
He was a prodigal, like, or maybe he was, like, on the spectrum or something. But he was, like, amazing with video games. And they, like – try to get to the like some video game contest, and he's got the Nintendo glove that he's wearing. That was the first time I ever saw the power glove. Yeah, and he wears that, and he plays Super Mario Brothers 3, and he wins.
Yeah, it was one of those movies that it was pretty much just an advertisement for Nintendo. That was its only purpose.
Yeah, it was a very extensive product placement movie for sure. Yeah, yeah.
It was before the internet, where you would find out about like a game's release from Nintendo Power. That was the only way that you would know, oh, this game is coming out, you know, or if you got it from what were the other magazines that were going on during that time.
I believe, I don't think Game Informer was going.
No, GamePro wasn't
EGM?
A thing.
Was it EGM?
EGM, that yeah. would be EGM. It. Yeah. So it was basically, that's how you got your video game information. And then The Wizard came out, which was, the entire advertising campaign was just touting the next big thing from Nintendo, which of course they saved for the last like 5 minutes of the movie, as they should. But the entire movie is just an advertisement of Nintendo products. Here's the Nintendo Entertainment System. Here's the Power Glove.
Yes.
Here's, you know, the Rob robot.
Robot Rob, yeah.
Yep. It was one of those movies that's so bad, but was cherished back then because everybody was like, oh my God, it's a movie about video games. This is spectacular. Mm-hmm. Or whatever it was that they said back then.
Tubular.
Tubular. There's
bodacious.
Rad. It was rad.
It's so bad. You have no idea.
You remember War Games with that dude from Ferris Bueller's Day Off?
Yes.
Matthew Broderick.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That was a great movie.
Like I said, I'm terrible with names, okay? I'm just going to name them for what they do or what they're in, but not their names. You know? Yeah. Like that old guy in all the Marvel movies.
You still lost your nerd card for that one. It's all over for you. But yeah, War Games was another great one that, you know, it had a lot of video game essence into it, but it was kind of playing the backseat of everything else. It was kind of the other movie that people always compare it to is Hackers, which is
the Angelina Jolie one from the 90s.
No, the one about
crap. I know which one you're talking about, too.
It was about the hacking the Gibson is the famous quote from it. I can't remember what year it came out, though. And I can't remember any of the actors in it either because it was just 1995. But yeah, that was another one that people always compare to War Games because it has the same kind of central element to it.
Yeah, it's got Angelina Jolie in it.
Is it the one with Angelina Jolie?
Oh. It is.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. You came out in 95?
Yep.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But yeah. Yeah, you got me on that one. Dang it. I got nothing.
Like, and, you know, we also kind of forgot about, like, obviously on top of, like, movies that deal with video games, like, what about, like, TV shows that have a segment for video games? Like, example, Make Love Not Warcraft from South Park.
But still the best episode of South Park.
Yeah, and the amount of... It's you want to talk about product placement. The whole episode was World of Warcraft. But yeah, like something like that, like where that whole episode, like everything was – the whole episode was done in like an area in World of Warcraft. It was all about some guy who was like some really great player and like he had gotten to the highest level possible and was one-hitting people and somehow figured out a way to kill people.
Even the mods.
Yeah, even the mods without asking. He could just kill them. And then like the end-all be-all was just some flash drive in someone's desk. It was like the Sword of Aeon or something like that. It was just like, why do you have a sword in your desk and it's not in the game? Why did you even make it?
The programmer side of me, which I don't know a lot about code, but I know enough about code to know that if you just plug a flash drive in, it doesn't just upload it to the server to make it an actual item you can like, pass around.
And not only just not upload it, they went to a product locked Best Buy demo unit. That has probably very limited internet access and probably none of the ports that you can access work.
That's somehow a demo unit for World of Warcraft.
Right. Like
I've never seen before at a Best Buy.
I don't think I've ever seen a demo unit for anything that's connected to the internet.
Yeah.
I just love the fact that it was like Stan's dad, Randy, that hands him. He's like, okay, so how do I do this? I got to push this and push F and then click that. And then you hand it over and he's like, no, so I do this.
Yeah, South Park has a lot of great video game-based episodes.
That episode was definitely award-winning, for sure.
I think it got nominated for something. Emmy,
yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, because there was the episode on the Nintendo Wii. Or no, it was like three episodes on the Nintendo Wii.
Every video game console episode is great.
Yeah.
Even the non-real ones, like the Okana GameSphere with Towley.
Oh, yeah.
That episode actually won a Primetime Emmy.
World of Warcraft one? Yeah. It won something. I knew that. Because it says so on the DVD.
Yeah.
Cartman freezes himself and goes into the future so he doesn't have to wait for the Nintendo Wii.
Yeah. I want to say that actually was in the same season, like season 10 or something. Yeah. Yeah, because the episode was called, Go God Go or something like that. And then what was the recent one they did for the Stick of Truth? Like, it was a couple episodes leading up to it with, like, a kind of Game of Thrones vibe, but they were fighting over the PS4 and the Xbox One.
Are you talking about just the console wars?
Yeah, the console wars one.
Yeah.
Xbox One and PS4, yeah.
Yeah.
I know Big Bang Theory did that. I know Big Bang Theory was one of the, like, you know, actual live action TV shows that focus a lot on video games, especially with Sheldon around.
Yeah, Sheldon
reminded me of that episode when the PS4 and the Xbox came out. He's just sitting there for like 5 minutes trying to figure out which one to buy, and he's like asking his girlfriend. She's like, just freaking pick one. And I know Big Bang Theory did a lot of video game based episodes, just mainly because that was kind of the center of the show, which is geek culture and everything else like that.
Mm-hmm. Geek culture with no humor.
Yeah, and laugh tracks.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of some other TV shows that had like an episode completely dedicated to a video game that were like huge.
I got another movie while you guys think of one.
Didn't Chuck have some?
I think of.
NBC, the TV show, the guy that worked at Geek Squad.
I thought Chuck had an episode.
There might have been one, but I can't recall it.
Yeah,
there was.
I thought they did.
Do you guys remember what was it, the Adam Sandler movie, Grandma's Boy?
Oh, yeah, that one.
Yeah.
New high score. What does that mean? Did I break it? Still one of my favorite quotes.
It was all about, you know, working in a video game company.
What do you guys think about that movie with Gerard Butler? Gamer? Do you remember that one?
Wasn't it like a prison-based one where it's like...
Where he took control of the character and...
Yeah.
They were inmates on death row. And basically, they had to go into a game and win. And if they died, they died in real life. But basically, they were already going to die anyways because they're on death row. And if they won, then they would, you know, they would get extended life without, you know. But of course, if you died, you got blown up and stuff like that. I thought it was a good. It also had Michael C. Hall. It had a good concept, but
you kind of reminded me of The Running Man with Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yeah, it kind of similar to that. I mean, it was a good concept. I think it had some issues with it, but it was a cool concept on how they did it. But it came out like 2007 or 2008, I think.
Yeah, it was like pre 2010. I know that, but yeah, good concept. Terrible, you know, outcome
execution
from that movie. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so let me ask you guys this. Who does it better? What usually is better in regards to film and television? Is it movie, or is it, you know, films with a video game theme to them, or are they video game films?
Films with a video game theme to them.
Yeah.
100%. Because I can name five good movies in that category. I can name zero in the other.
Yeah.
Well, the difference is, like, when you see a video game movie, you go like, oh, that's cool. That's a cool little reference, you know, here and there. But, like, in these movies like Scott Pilgrim, like, when you hear the Zelda theme, you know, when he's playing his 3 and you hear the Zelda theme in the background, or, you know, like, in even though it's not video game, like the Gundam, or just when you see these references, you get that inner, you know, nerd inside you just gets all giddy. Like, that's just something that video game movies don't do. Like, there's some cool stuff in video game movies, but none of them makes you like happy to be a nerd. Like Ready Player One, Scott Pilgrim, Wreck-It-Ralph.
Like the fanboy kicks in you.
Yeah, that's the one thing that these video game movies are doing. And there are some, like, you know, home video movies, like animated, that do a good job, but like that's the one thing that these video game movies are missing. And that's because they're not, the people who are making them don't have that heart, like, let's say, Steven Spielberg or Edgar Wright. You know, they're not these nerds at heart. they're just people who played it, but they don't have a passion for it. And I think that's one thing that a lot of these video game movies are missing.
And it's almost like – it's weird when you have the person who's directing a movie that's kind of dancing around the concept or dancing around the idea. They use the source material better than someone who's literally given the entire source material to ruin it. Like a video game – it's not very hard. As a video game movie, it's really not hard to translate what you're seeing in cutscenes just in a format where it's easy to follow. But somehow it gets ruined every time, whether it be a costume issue or someone is cast in the wrong role or someone's name is pronounced the whole time the wrong way.
Or they don't even look at the source material at all and just go, title, movie.
But done. It's like Rampage. Like, I don't know if you guys knew this about Rampage.
Yeah,
but
the gorilla is not white.
Not even that. The gorilla isn't even a gorilla. It's a human being that got transformed into an animal. Like,
right.
Yeah. I grew up on this game. I beat the game. I have it on Nintendo. I've played it a multitude of times. You know, I can play with my eyes closed. When the, you know, the gorilla or the giant, you know, lizard gets defeated, it falls to the ground. It shrinks down and it's a human being that's naked and walks away.
Right.
Like, this is an animal that gets in the movie, like,
they just
touches
found
something
it in the wild.
And it finds something in the wild, just gets bigger and bigger. Like, and it makes no sense to me. Right. So it's just like, there's no even connection with that.
It's like they literally, it was like, all right, well, here's the source material. I want you to make a movie like this. And you're like, ha! And they just throw it on the ground and probably just piss on it real quick. And I'm like,
no,
I'm
they
make
rip
my
off
own movie.
The first page with the title. Yeah. And go, nah, the rest of this isn't needed.
Yeah.
I got all I need right here.
It's like, but then you get those movies like obviously by Edgar Wright, and then you obviously get like with Steven Spielberg, like they put their heart into it. They find things that they enjoyed from it, and they stick to that because they know that they can put their heart to it, and they know they can dedicate their time to it instead of trying to figure out something that they may not understand or something that they may not want to do or just doing it because there's a paycheck involved. Like as Brad said, like – I don't think there's a single video game movie that I can say, this is my movie. This is the one that is the best one. If you don't believe me, you're a problem kind of thing. But like when it comes to any movie that's video game-esque or just geek culture-esque, almost all of them are perfect in some way, shape, or form. So
there's something that you can take away from most of them. And you can tell which ones are the cash grabs still. Like you can watch Tron and go, there was heart and soul put into this. And then you can watch Pixels, the Adam Sandler movie, and go, yeah, this was a cash grab 100%. There was no heart behind this at all. Then you can go back and watch Wreck-It Ralph and go, that there was heart and soul put into this.
There was time put into it, yes. I agree. And you guys got a really, really good point, and it's that, you know, how much of the time the production values involved with making it accurate and putting into the details and things like that. And you definitely see that more in films that are video game based, but not ones that are cash grab movies that are, you know, video game movies.
It also helps that they don't have to think of lore. Like in Ready Player One, they don't care where Master Chief comes from when he's fighting across from Hello Kitty against Mechagodzilla. You know, it's not even a thought in their heads. They're going, we're going to make a good movie and here are our tools to do it. But we're going to make sure to keep them as close to what they should represent. But that is all the time that we have here on The Breakfast Table. But as always, you can catch our backlog of episodes on Google Play and on iTunes. And in between our episodes, you can catch us on Facebook, Instagram, and on Twitter. Until next time, this has been The Breakfast Table.